Hi, I'm Michael Harlan Turkel, your host. You are listening to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. Today's episode is brought by Brooklyn Bowl, dubbed by Rolling Stone as one of the greatest places on earth. Brooklyn Bowl's timely blend of live music, food by Blue Ribbon, and of course, bowling is perfect strike every time. Brooklyn Bowl features diverse live performances from Snoop Dogg to Dr. Dog, The Roots to Gaslight Anthem to the Disco Biscuits and so many more, as well as the hottest in local up and coming talent. Brooklyn Bowl is located at 61 Wythe Ave in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, a short walk from the L or G subway. They hope to see you at the lane soon. Today, I am very happy to have Melissa Clark, New York Times food writer, cookbook author, on the show. Her work has this sensibility, this prose, this poetry that even if you're not in the location, traveling around the world, she brings international cuisine to your kitchen from her travels, from her experiences, and makes you feel it is some kind of zeitgeist. It has this overall feeling that you've experienced it with her. And that's what we're going to talk about a little bit, about the difference between articles and reviews and how to stylize yourself as a writer, especially dealing with such interesting egos as chefs in collaborating with cookbooks. Thank you for being on the show, Melissa.
Oh, thank you so much.
So, actually, you have a book coming out pretty soon, In the Kitchen with a Good Appetite.
Yep. And that one, yeah, it's coming out in September. And that one is based on the New York Times column. So it's a book, it's all my recipes, it's not chef's recipes for this one. And it's the idea of the column is, how does a cook think? You know, when you're in the kitchen and you're looking in your fridge or you're in the supermarket and you're like, what do I want to eat? And then you say, okay, I'm in the mood for whatever. I'm in the mood for like shrimp. And then how you start, that starting point gets you to the final dish. Like, what's the story behind that?
So it's kind of like, not based on the TV show Chopped, but in a similar vein, that you have these ingredients in front of you and you just have so many, you know, different routes that you can take and how to actually start traveling those.
Exactly. Well, and except that it should start from your hunger, you know, so, you know, it's like, what do I want to eat? And I think that's the biggest question for me every time I start cooking is, what am I hungry for? What do I feel like eating and getting in touch with, first of all, that, and then going from there. And like, okay, I really want shrimp. And I look in the fridge, I'm like, okay, well, tofu. All right. So how do I make it taste sort of shrimpy, or how do I satisfy that urge?
So are you taking elements and ingredients first rather than experiences, trying to figure out your, you know, how to feed your hunger?
Well, that's a really good question, because sometimes, you know, hunger comes from not just a physical sensation, but sometimes it's you're hungering for an experience that you've had before, right? Like a memory will make you hungry. So I can be thinking about, oh God, this amazing sandwich that I used to eat when I was a little kid that my mother made me. And I'll think, oh, I want that.
Well, what is that
and
sandwich?
That she used I want to make. Now. She used to make these panbagnats, and it's basically a glorified tuna sandwich. But instead of mayonnaise, it was with olive oil and chopped olives and capers and garlic and mustard, and it was just a really rich, savory
thing.
You
ate much better as a child than I did.
I was really lucky, actually. My parents are foodies, so I was really lucky. And so I could be thinking about that, and I could just be remembering, you know, we used to eat it on vacation, and it always reminds me of the beach. So I could be thinking about the beach, and then all of a sudden I'll think, oh, that sandwich. And it isn't even that I wanted necessarily to eat a tuna sandwich, but I just wanted to be at the beach. But then I get hungry for a tuna sandwich because I want to be at the beach. Yeah. Do you know what I mean?
So it's all these stimuli, you know, from the weather to, you know, the fresh produce.
Right, exactly. Or I could just be looking at a turnip, like a beautiful bunch of those, you know, those little Japanese turnips?
Little harukis.
Yes, those. And I could just be looking at those thinking, I want to eat, those are so good. I want to eat them raw, but really that's not, a bunch of raw turnips isn't dinner, so how do I make them into dinner? Yeah. And so it totally depends.
Actually, that was funny. You just had an article about roasted radishes, which I thought was very interesting. What was the impetus for that piece?
That one, I feel like they're really trendy now. I feel like I've seen them everywhere.
Well, I don't know if I consider myself ahead of the curve, but I love radishes and have always been eating them, dealing with
them
for years.
You're not, so you've probably made roasted radishes before,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
See, so they're, for me, they were new. I just started seeing them in restaurants and I, you know, places near my house had them, and, you know, like little takeout shops would start having them, and I saw them in cookbooks and online and magazines, and I thought, well, I've never roasted a radish before. And it just never occurred to me, because to me, radishes were, you know, I did one thing with them. I ate them raw.
Oh, yeah.
In just salad. Like, right.
My favorite thing to eat actually is little radish toast, fresh French bread, sliced thin radishes. But I make a compound butter with lavender and it just like perfumes, brings out little sea salt. And that's it. Sometimes maybe some fleur vert goat cheese, and it's like really perfectly springtimey. But it was actually a very specific radish that brought me into the love of all things radish. It's this Japanese one called aburigako. Ooh. Which is, I call it the andouille of radishes.
Is it sort of...
Well, it's smoked. They take it after Sakura Matsuri, the cherry festival, String it up in little huts, and I think smoke it with cedarwood for about 8 days behind their houses. And,
oh my God.
Yeah, and...
That's crazy. Exactly. I've never heard of that before.
No, I'm one for, like, I love the history and etymology of things, so to hear about that and then taste it, and it be all that and more, you know, encompass everything, you know, encompass... the time and place and compass history. It just, it was quite
and so
a
what did you see? Where do you even find those? And then when you find them, what do you do with that?
I think the Akita Prefecture of Japan. So,
okay, so I'm not going to be able to.
But I mean, you can create your own little hut in the backyard and try to replicate that thing. But
I'm really going to be doing that.
Oh, you know, turn the Sakote into, you know, an aburigako hut, you know, so maybe that would work. But yeah, it's these experiences which I see in your work so much. Recent ones like a Caesar salad or a tiramisu or the beef stir fry, I mean, they're not just based in singular entities, they're based in experience. And what are some of your favorite, you know, simple American dishes that have tons of legacy and lore and understanding behind them?
You know, it's funny that you mention American food, because I'm thinking right now about cherry pie, because I'm desperate for cherry pie.
And as am I.
I'm hawking all of the farmers at the farmer's market. When are the sour cherries going to be in? When are the, and they're looking at me like, July, lady, cool your heels, you know? But so cherry pie is one of the first things I think of. And, you know, for some reason, I mean, obviously it comes into cherries come into season around 4th of July. So to me, it is my sort of quintessential 4th of July American dessert, even though, you know, historically, except for George Washington, you know, chopping down that cherry tree, which obviously never happened. You know, there's no real link. But it just feels like, because it's so seasonal and it just comes around, it just to me feels very patriotic.
Have you ever been to Michigan?
You know, I have never. It's upper, right? It's in the Upper Peninsula where they have all the...
It's a UP thing. No, actually, Traverse City has a huge one. My girlfriend was born and raised in Michigan. Her family's still there, and we usually go to Traverse City. And last year, we went for July 4th, which was a cherry festival. Everything cherry, and you do not get sick of them.
Oh, God. I'll bet. And do they do sour ones there, too?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's the whole spectrum from... how do you say it? Montournay to Balaton to... I mean, the varietals are amazing.
And,
I mean, it's a cherry capital, it's asparagus capital, it's, I think, possibly the morel capital of the country, too. And these things are just plush and beautiful there, and it just, mouthwatering.
So, right, talk about American food, exactly. Yeah. You know, it's funny, because morels are, obviously, they're such an American ingredient.
Yeah.
And I didn't, you know, because we have them, you know, I mean, they have them in different parts of the world, too. But to me, we have such good ones here.
Yeah.
You know, and I had always, mostly, when I first had morels, you know, they're always dried, you know, because we didn't even, you know, we were importing them from France, I guess, you know, so we didn't even know we had these amazing morels. I mean, I guess in big cities, I guess if you live near a forest and you knew they were there, but it didn't become a thing until like the 80s, right?
Yeah, yeah, I think.
And, you know, I just feel like even now people don't even know that there are these amazing morels just all over the country. And asparagus also, it's another thing. It's like we would import our asparagus from Europe.
Exactly.
You know, which it's just crazy.
It's funny that like all this French technique came over, and so did French product, and we didn't realize that we had it here.
Well, right.
And once like the American food movement started catching up and understanding that, you know, we have our own technique and our own fruits, vegetables, produce.
Yeah. And that, in fact, and I mean, this was so long before it was all about local, you know?
Yeah,
I
mean,
it was just like, and I remember this because it was, you know, I guess it was the early 90s when I met Larry Forgione, you know, who's like, you know,
he's a big figure like in Alice, Traverse City. Right, like, American Spoon, I think, is located in Petoskey, Michigan.
Which is right there, right?
Yeah.
And so Larry Forgione, you know, and he, you know, his name doesn't get, you don't hear as much about him as you do about Alice Waters, but, you know, really they work together to try to put American food on the map and to try to get us to appreciate all these ingredients. And I really think that they were the, I mean, of course, Alice, we all know, is the beginning of the locavore movement, but Larry too, you know, and I feel like he doesn't get as much credit.
Yeah, that's what happens every once in a while, I think, in middle America, is that, you know, the media blitz on some coastal venues from San Francisco, LA, New York, well, now Chicago, but places like Michigan didn't necessarily get it, even though they were larger part of agribusiness in the country. I mean, not just through subsidies, but through the amount that they farm and intake.
Yeah.
So, I think it actually like took a while for people to understand that local in the United States wasn't just within the 100-mile radius. It was going to Cleveland or going to Topeka,
right,
and seeing what's genuine in that area.
Right, and appreciating it. And it's true. I mean, it was all about the coasts. But
definitely. I actually wanted to talk a little about your cookbooks, because you have all this personal experience, mm-hmm, and then you collaborate with a lot of chefs, like you did Danielle Ballou's Braise, Chef Interrupted, been working with the Dean Brothers, even older books like Waldy Malouf's High Heat, which I love, mm-hmm, and Sylvia's Soul Food.
David Boulay.
David Boulay. Bill Yosef's most recent. I mean, the list just goes on and on, and it's almost, 20 books?
Yeah.
How do you... Well, I wouldn't say compromise, but how do you incorporate or amalgamate your style, your vision, mm-hmm, writing for these chefs?
Oh, I don't. I mean, my vision just goes out the window.
Yeah.
You know, which is hard sometimes because, you know, it's funny, I've changed. You know, I've been doing these chef's books for a really long time. And at the beginning, every time I worked with a new chef, I learned an entire new way to do everything, from chop an onion to sear a steak to when you add the salt. And it was this whole new, you know, set of techniques every single time, every single chef. And as I moved from chef to chef, I was like, oh, but Waldy Malouf would do it this way, but oh, David Boulay does it this way. And then I would change. I'd be like, oh, okay, well, that way is no good anymore. I like to do it. And so I would, you know, it was almost like I took it in as just so far as I was working with the chef. And then this was the beginning. And then all of a sudden it occurred to me, or maybe not all of a sudden, maybe slowly, I realized, okay, well, I actually have a lot of knowledge at my fingertips and I can
You've been staging with the best.
Yeah, yeah. And I've like learned all of their techniques and now I can pick and choose. It is like staging.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, that's why restaurant chefs are so good at what they do, because they work with so many different people and they take in these techniques and then they know exactly when to apply it. Like now I know there's sometimes you need to salt right at the beginning and sometimes you need to salt right at the end, and I can really make that call, and there's no way to say, you know, it's so much of it is feel. It's not like I can explain to you why.
Do you have
I'm doing
an example or instance of when to salt before, when to
well
salt after?
Yeah, so I remember when Judy Rogers' Zuni Cafe cookbook came out, she salts everything. Like she takes her chicken she gets her chicken home from the supermarket, or well, she probably doesn't, not the supermarket, excuse me, Judy Rogers. She gets her chicken in from the farmer's market,
the super space market,
exactly, from the farmer down the road who's, you know, growing it for her, and she salts it immediately, and doesn't matter if she plans to cook it that day, the next day, or the day after, she is salting that chicken the second she gets it home. Same thing with meat, same thing with fish. And I've made so many recipes from her book and they're great. They totally work. But then I just made this recipe a couple of days ago from Marcus Samuelson's pretty recent cookbook.
The New American?
Or The Soul of, what is it called? Yes. I guess it was his other one, The Soul. It's his Ethiopian, African, Pan-African.
Oh, yeah.
And I made this dish and he salts it right at the end. And as I was tasting the sauce, you know, it was such a different experience for me, because I usually salt at the beginning, and it was this chicken dish, this very famous Ethiopian chicken dish, called dorawet or dorawat, something like that.
Yeah.
And the flavor, to me, could taste the spices in two completely different ways, from the beginning without the salt and to the end when I added the salt. And I feel like not to say that it would have, I would have changed the amount of salt or the way I use the salt, but it gave me an appreciation of the balance of the spices in a different way. So I knew that I needed to add more clove, and I don't know that I would have known that
with the salt.
Yeah, I feel like it really, it focused my ability to taste. And so now I'm like, oh, well, maybe I shouldn't add the salt. So maybe I should only add the salt to early, this is a theory that I'm working on, early if something is very simple and plain and you're showing off the ingredient. But if it's a more complex stew with layered flavors, maybe that's when you really do need to add the salt at the end. So I don't know, but I love thinking about this stuff. And I feel like I'm going to keep changing. Every time I work with someone, I'm going to keep changing and evolving my own style.
Exactly.
And,
it's almost too hard to know so much. And you know, have all these techniques under your belt to actually make a simple decision.
Yeah, I can't. Yeah. It's all complicated, but it's great. And at the same time, so then I'll probably write about it. You know, I'll write a column of like, well, when do you salt? And then other people will write in, and I just love the discussion.
See, we're going to take a break right now and come back and talk about the differences between simple techniques such as salting before, after, and we'll see you soon. we're back. This is Michael Harlan Turkel. You're listening to The Food Scene on Heritage Radio Network. I have Melissa Clark, a food writer for New York Times, A Good Appetite, cookbook author, here. And we were just talking about something as simple as salt, before, after, when I actually apply it to dishes. And sometimes it's those simple techniques with, you know, having gone through the age of molecular gastronomy and, you know, sous vide, that we forget sometimes it's liberally applying something that simple that makes the difference in the dish. And do you have any other techniques, or, you know, when to add pepper, or when to, you know, apply heat, or when to brine things, that at first was the, you know, norm for years, but now...
Oh, yeah, I do, yeah. Actually. Onions. Okay, so for years, when I was sauteing onions, I always thought you needed to not let them turn brown, right? Unless you were making caramelized onions.
Yeah.
But if you were just, say, you were making a stew, and I guess I picked this up from reading so many cookbooks, you know, and the garlic, too. Do not let the garlic and onions get brown. I heard that in my head. I read that over and over. And you know what? It's totally different flavor profile if you let them get brown, but
yeah,
it's really good.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
And then I learned from this other chef I worked with. I did several books with Peter Burley, who's fabulous.
Yeah,
and
flexitarian.
I didn't do the flexitarian, yeah, actually. My friend did that one. But I did two, the modern vegetarian and fresh food fast.
Yeah.
And Peter was, we were talking about making caramelized onions, and he said, well, what about browned onions? And what you do is you put the onion in the pan without any oil at all, and you get them black, totally black.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, that's going to be disgusting. And it was so good. It was so, if you've ever had, I think it's certain Middle Eastern fried onion preparations where it's like really crunchy and really dark.
Oh, yeah.
That's how they make it.
Yeah, like Mujahara.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I had just learned that. So I've totally changed the way I think about onions. And now I know that if I want a really deep, rich, super smoky flavor, I don't use oil. I put them in the pan dry. I let them get super brown, and then I add my fat.
Interesting. Actually, I was
if you want sweet, then you start with the fat.
Yeah. It was interesting. I was just at a meal out in San Francisco at an Encanto restaurant. Chef Chris Cosentino does this head to tail dinner every year, which is just
amazing, right?
Epic, yeah. Epic. I've been going for years, but this year, a phenomenal little thing was onion ash. And it was burnt onions with, I think, nigella, which is...
Right, the onion seed.
Yeah, yeah, just crushed up and dusted on the side of a plate of, I forget what kind of organ meat it was, but with fra diavolo.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, you hear ash. You hear ash, and maybe, you know, you put it on the outside of a cheese for it to age, but to put something burnt on a dish seems so odd, but it was absolutely awesome how it balanced out the spiciness and heat of, you know, the fra diavolo without having grill the, you know, heart and stuff that much. It was just absolutely fantastic.
Okay, that's brilliant. That's okay. I'm going to try that. Now, how can I make ash at home? I wonder if I just keep cooking it. I guess it'll
I think you just
ash.
Keep cooking, or you dry it and dehydrate it, or the oven and just pulverize it and just use it as, you know, its own spice. I mean,
I love that.
It was pretty awesome. It puts the grill without having to actually have the fire in there.
And nigella is something I'm going through a big nigella phase.
Yeah.
I've used it in the past.
Oh, yeah.
The other day, I had spring onions, you know, beautiful fresh spring onions from the farmer's market, and I thought, let's add another onion component, so I added nigella. Oh!
Yeah, I can't.
The flavor is so complex.
It's in my bread blend now. That caraway seed and fennel is just, absolutely to die for. So, I showed Melissa an old article of hers, I think from 2003?
Sounds
about
right.
About the far-out foods of Brooklyn, and I don't care if there's not a segue. I just can't not mention this at the moment because it was just so interesting to see her pull out 10 dishes that were not only pushing the culinary envelope, but kind of defining the borough and, you know, it being 7-8 years later, how those things have shifted. She had things like cow's foot soup at a Cox Bajan Bakery on Ostrand Ave, Vietnamese noodle shop with beef tendon, braised duck feet at Ocean Palace, chicken and corn fungus sauce at Bonita, the spleen sandwich at Ferdinando's Focaccia, which I love. I absolutely love.
With the ricotta.
I go there, and for the chickpea pinot, I'm completely fine. And
you know, a spleen, it's not the most flavorful thing in the world, but it just, with all that other, it just works.
Yeah.
With the ricotta and the chewy texture.
I actually wrote a little something for Edible Brooklyn on her blog a while ago, because I was not only fascinated by that sandwich, but to find out they've been there for over 100 years.
Oh, yeah.
That vistetta, the spleen, mm-hmm, is actually one of the initial forms of muffuletta.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, everyone knows muffuletta in, you know, Central Grocery in New Orleans. Yeah. It's this big, big round sandwich with a whole bunch of meats.
Well, you think of salumi in that. You don't
and
think of
olive spreads. But in Palermo, the street food was actually these vistettas, these little snacky sandwiches. Because muffuletta, I think, means like little sack or little ball. Mm-hmm. And they were these bite-sized sandwiches like at Fernino's. Rather than these giant, immense, you know, like blue-collar lunch break, sit down and eat sandwiches. You grabbed them, you were on the go, and fascinated by the history of it. And I don't think people have highlighted, you know, how amazing Fernino's really is. I think it's 106, and Central Grocery is only 104.
So. Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
So they have the...
They might have had their original muffuletta.
That's awesome.
Yeah, yeah. Well, in the States, so there might be a little debate going there. Lamb's Head Three Ways at Chicken Bone Cafe.
God, Chicken Bone Cafe. Those were the days.
Yeah, and now Zach has an empire.
I know.
The Grilled Beef Heart at Coco Roco. Two extraordinary Sweden icy drinks at Younga Malaysian Cuisine. And then Brain Tripe and Tongue Tacos at Tacos Nueva Mexico.
That was a fun article.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Do you get to run around the borough like that?
I got to run around the borough. No, not anymore. I have a kid now.
Yeah,
so you know, I can't be like, okay, Dahlia, we're going for spleen sandwiches. She'd be like,
best baby food around the borough.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I don't get to run around like that. But that was so fun because it was not just running around. I was really looking for the, you know, these interesting things that I don't get to eat every day. I mean, how often do you get to, you know, say, okay, everybody, let's go and, you know, try find goat head, you know?
Yeah. Well, do you think any of these have become commonplace now?
That's a good question. I feel like the drinks, you know, those crazy drinks with like, I mean, I feel like we're so used to bubble tea that that those, you know, drinks with different all kind. What is in those? Like the
those little tapioca pearls.
Those little tapioca, and then the basil, the sprouted basil seeds, and the vermicelli, and the. I feel like we see those a lot more than we have.
Yeah.
I don't know if any of the other ones have really become.
I think the most of the rest of it is offal.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah,
it's funny to mention Chris Cosentino in the same vein, but I mean, do you see that coming more to the forefront?
And they use that, right, like use the whole animal. I mean, so we're seeing a lot more offal, which is great.
Yeah.
I mean, because first of all, it's delicious. It's underappreciated. Unfortunately, now it's getting expensive. Used to be able to buy that stuff really cheaply.
I mean, it used to be called low cuts and guts because it just would drop on the floor and be swept away in the facilities.
Right, and nobody wanted it.
Yeah, yeah.
And now that we're, but it's important to use the whole animal. It's important to appreciate the whole animal. While it's more expensive, it's more accessible. Well, accessible, not really. It's more available. You see it more. You know, like testa, you know, you see that everywhere. Who's not making their own testa these days?
Yeah, I think actually here at Roberta's, where we're taping, they make a couple different kinds of charcuterie using different organ meats. I can't remember exactly. Maybe there was like a tongue dish recently.
Everybody's making a tongue terrine. And why not? It's yummy. It's so tasty. And again, we should be using... we should be using the whole animal.
So with those same applications, using, you know, offal, etc., what are the dishes these days that are defining Brooklyn?
Okay. Oh, you want the offal dishes? Oh, I thought...
No, not just offal. Just, you know, that they're taking something what was extraordinarily out there then to make it extraordinarily commonplace now.
Right.
What do you think are the dishes that are, you know, not common today that are going to be more common 10 years from now?
Oh, okay. I see. Well, definitely, I think we're going to continue in that vein. We're going to see more, more homemade salumi. I think that's just going to continue now that people, you know, are interested in crafting everything. You know, I feel like people want to make everything they serve in their restaurants by themselves, and I think that's fantastic. I think we're going to see people even making their own condiments that you would never think of making. I mean, okay, ketchup is one thing.
Yeah.
Yes, we all make ketchup. But I think I could see people brewing their own miso, doing their own soy sauce, really taking it to that extreme.
Oh, yeah. I have about 6 different misos in the fridge and a whole bunch of koji.
And you're making it?
My cousin makes her own miso.
Yeah. She's got a whole thing in her basement, too. Yeah, so... And it's the best miso I've ever had.
Oh, yeah.
So why not? That's another thing is you get diversity and you get a very specific flavor to where you are. And I mean, if you're making your own miso, it's not going to taste like miso.
You know, it's interesting. The things that you've mentioned so far, like, you know, those condiments and miso and charcuterie and sausages are all very time consuming, you know? And then there was this like big a la minute movement for a long time where it was like fresh, fast, don't touch it. And now, you know, San Francisco's getting chastised every once in a while for putting, what was the quote from that New York Times article?
Oh, right.
Figs on a plate.
Right.
Yeah. But, you know, is it this slow and low mentality, this DIY, you know, that you actually invest time
Well, I mean, I think, you know, we're starting to see, I mean, with restaurants with farms on the tops of the gardens, on the, yeah, like,
not just on the top, right above our heads right now.
Exactly, right above our heads right now. And that's, so we're talking low and slow. We're talking really low. We're talking about growing everything and using it to, you know, you grow the food, you use it, you save seeds, you know, I mean, so that you're investing in next year, then you're making the condiments, you're making your jams, you're making your preserves, you're flavoring your oils, you're really doing it all yourself. And I do feel like so much of it is just wanting to be closer and closer to your food and really wanting it to be an expression of who you are and what you're trying to say. And if you're buying that stuff, it's someone else's expression. It's someone else's idea, yeah, and not yours.
Well, interesting. Coming for full circle, in the kitchen with a good appetite, do you feel like your cookbook's sustainable in that way? Or are you just getting these urges to go out and get these special ingredients?
Oh, that's a good question. Yeah, you know, I mean, I feel like there are the people who are cooking in restaurants and doing all the do-it-yourself stuff and certain like really passionate foodies. But I feel like the majority of people they just want to cook.
Yeah.
They just want to get in front and they just don't know how to do it. And as much as I embrace, you know, I embrace the do-it-yourself movement so much. I care about it so much. And I support it as much as I can. I'm really speaking to the people who just want to cook.
Yeah.
And I feel like, and I guess that is speaking to everybody too, because even once once you've crafted your own miso, it's like, okay, now what are you going to do?
Exactly.
You're going to put it on duck? What are you going to do with it? And what I hope my book does is just inspire people to get in the kitchen, cook. Don't follow the recipe. Follow your hunger. You know, what are you hungry for? And go, just make it. This is how you do it.
Yeah.
This is what I'm hungry for. Maybe you're hungry for the same thing. If not, take my recipe and go to town. Do whatever you... I love it when people write in and say, oh, I made this, but I didn't have that, so I changed it. I'm like, hey, you sound like me.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think you put such a wonderful basis to your recipes that you do actually leave that latitude to incorporate new flavors, change new things. And it's more about, you know, that repetition of cooking all these things to realize, oh, I can cook and
right.
I can riff on my own
and
recipes.
And, you know, it's just not that hard. I mean, people are scared. I'm a little bit scared. I used to be a little bit scared of gardening.
Yeah.
So I understand why people are scared of cooking, because I would go, I'd have the plants, I'd have the pot, I'd have the soil, and be like, What do I do? And, you know, I'd be like, okay, I put the soil in the pot. I put the plant in the soil. But there was this barrier of, I'm going to hurt it. I'm going to do it wrong. And so I understand when people feel that way in the kitchen, like, oh my God, I've got the salmon. I've got the olive oil. I've got the pan. What do I do? And so, you know, but once you do it, you just have to do it. And you realize, hey, it's really not that hard.
Yeah. What was your breakthrough dish? I mean, what got you past the fear of cooking and into, you know, writing and...
Well, you know, for me, I was always a big recipe follower. So I, you know, when I was growing, I've always cooked since I was a little kid. I cooked. As soon as my parents let me touch the stove, I cooked and I followed recipes. And I really started experimenting. I mean, for me, it was early just because I had done it so much. And I really started experimenting when I was in high school. For me, it was brownies. I mean, that was my kind of, I was like, hey, I mean, it doesn't, you know, now it doesn't sound like anything like, hey, you can swap out the, you know, walnuts and you can put in, you know, chopped up candy bars,
yeah,
you know, or for me, it was like, ooh, M&Ms, you know, and it sounds so like, of course you can, you know, I feel like, but for me, it was a big deal. It was like, I can make this. I really, really want to put chopped up almond joys in my brownies because I love almond joys. And I made it the way I wanted to eat it. And that was so pleasurable. That was that moment. And then there was a moment when I was in a restaurant in Soho. I was at the Old Provence. And I realized, you know, I was spending my own money. I had just gotten out of college.
Yeah.
I had a job, a credit card. It's like, I can order 3 desserts for 2 people and nobody can stop me. Like, you know, it was like this freedom of... I can eat the way I want to eat. If I want to eat,
I like that as
desserts,
a mantra. Make it how you want to make it. Eat it how you want to eat it.
Yeah, and that's just you. And you have to. You kind of have to really think about what you want to know that.
Yeah, and what do you want right now?
Yeah.
You mentioned cherry pie. I mean, what out of your book pie are you just dying to make when you go home?
Well, I never cook anything twice. So, I mean, do you
really? Yeah. I mean, it's very funny. I think I cook things tons and tons of times to tweak it, make it better, make it more
specific. But don't you change
it
just a little bit each time?
Very little. I try to standardize more than I try. I mean, I experiment a lot, but I also like try to...
Right, then you try to perfect.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that's a different tendency. I know that urge. That's really cool. I wish I had that. I tend to... I get it good enough, and then I'm like, let's go this way, you know?
Yeah, I have my signature dishes, so.
That's great.
Yeah.
Because you know that when you go to your house, it's going to be great. But for me, when people come over to my house, it's usually pretty good.
They
but it's
never
not,
know what they're going
to
get.
And my friends always say, they're like, can you make that dish you used to make? No, I guess you can't, can you? Okay, never mind.
So that just leads me to believe, if you ever go over to Melissa's house to eat, don't expect to come back and have the same wonderful dish twice, but you can make it yourself.
You can make it
how you want it.
Exactly.
You'd
be like, that salad you made with the cranberries and the pine nuts, I'm going to go home and I'm going to make it with dried mango. And
see, I'm starving now. Absolutely starving. Luckily, there are some wonderful pizzas waiting for us inside Roberto's. And that's all the time we have for today. And I'm just absolutely salivating. And yeah, I need some water, too, because we've been talking about food so much, I forget
how. I know. Don't you feel like you've just eaten a whole thing of popcorn with salt on it?
Ooh, now I want that too. Yeah. See, now if only
truffle
I can
salt.
Just even better. Now if I could just visualize these things and make it actually feel full sometimes, then I won't have to spend any money at these shops. You're listening to The Food Scene. This is Michael Harlan Turkel. Thank you so much again to our sponsor, Brooklyn Bowl, engineer Nat Wiener, and Jack Inslee. We are going to be live Tuesdays at 3 p.m., so give us a call sometime. Looking forward to hearing from you. And this is Michael Harlan Turkel. You're listening to The Food Scene on Heritage Radio Network. Thank you, Melissa.
Thank you.